It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Even though foreign policy is nowhere near a major issue for most voters this year, it was deemed important enough to merit a presidential debate this week. Monday night, President Obama and Mitt Romney outlined their visions for America's role in the world, and in many cases, the two men's approaches sounded pretty similar toward China, Iran, and Israel. But with other global hotspots, there were differences. For example, Governor Romney and President Obama tangled over who would better lead on the issue of Syria.
This is a critical opportunity for America. And what I'm afraid of is that we've watched over the past year or so, first the president saying, well, we'll let the UN deal with it. And Kofi Annan came in and said, we're going to try to have a ceasefire. That didn't work. Then it looked to the Russians and said, let's see if you can do something. We should be playing the leadership role there, not on the ground with military.
All right.
But play the leadership role.
We are playing the leadership role. We organized the Friends of Syria. We are mobilizing humanitarian support and support for the opposition. And we are making sure that those we help are those who will be friends of ours in the long term and friends of our allies in the region over the long term.
Here in New Hampshire, our candidates for Congress have occasionally waded into international waters as well, but they largely take their foreign policy playbooks from the top of their tickets. Today in The Exchange, our Issue of the Week series continues with foreign policy, what the contenders are saying about international affairs, from global conflicts to matters more connected with local concerns, such as immigration, trade, troop deployments, and how veterans are treated upon returning home. Let's hear from you. How much does foreign policy factor into your voting decisions? What issue in this area do you think candidates should be talking about more, especially here in New Hampshire? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post your comments on our Facebook page or the Exchange page at nhpr.org. We had three guests for the hour. Joining me in studio is Chris Galdieri, Assistant Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. He specializes in presidential politics. And Chris, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Wayne L'Esperance, Professor of Political Science at New England College, Director of the Center for Civic Engagement there. And Wayne, thanks for your time.
Thanks. Good morning.
And also with us from UNH, Kirk Dorsey, Professor of History there. His areas of expertise include U.S. foreign policy. And Kirk, good morning and welcome back to you, too.
Good morning, Laura. It's nice to be here.
Well, and Kirk, let's have the historical view on this, if we could, the long view on how much of a role foreign policy has typically played in our elections and how it's kind of waxed and waned in terms of importance.
Right. It does seem to me that in this election, it's been a very minor issue by comparison. And partially that's by comparison to past elections. Partially that's not surprising. The economy is dominating most voters' concerns with good reason at this point. I was thinking the other day that there hasn't been so little attention on foreign policy since maybe the 1996 election. I'm not sure that there would be anything memorable out of this election cycle in terms of the rhetoric about foreign policy. Even the 2000 election, there was that memorable moment where George Bush, trying to challenge the Clinton-Gore administration on nation building, had that famous line about the United States having a humble foreign policy if he were elected president. And of course, 9/11 challenged what all that meant. So it strikes me that this is an election, if you look at even that foreign policy debate, the most heat came from the economic policies at home that each candidate was trying to say, well, that ties back to foreign policy because it's how we exert strength overseas.
Right, even though it was supposedly about foreign policy, and largely it was. You're right, Kirk, they really wove in their economic messages there, didn't they?
That seemed to be the main point that each of them wanted to get across, and I think they're understanding that that's what the voters are paying attention to. I think even the Libya crisis, which has gotten so much attention recently, strikes me as being more about whether or not the administration is telling us the truth. Is it a truthful administration? More than the policy towards Libya. The policy towards Libya gets wrapped into it sometimes, but I think it's more about the character of the Obama administration, whether it's telling us the truth about whether it was terror and why would they not want to tell us if it was a terrorist attack, rather than analyzing, well, what might a Romney administration have done differently in that crisis?
Yeah, so following up on that then, Wayne, what is it exactly that voters are looking for in terms of this issue, whether they're hearing messages from the presidential candidates or from our congressional candidates? What is it that they're looking for? Do they want specifics or do they want just a general sense of a person's approach toward the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think that what voters are looking for more of is a sense of command of the issues. You know, do they pass the test of, you know, being knowledgeable about these issues that the country faces? You know, and I do think voters still are well aware that we are a nation at war. And so, you know, a responsible discussion of how we bring our men and women in uniform back home and then how we care for them once they're back home, that came into a couple of the congressional debates when talking about the war on terror. Candidates pivot to discuss, you know, veterans issues here at home. So, and that brings us to the third piece, the way in which the candidates talk about international relations or foreign policy and how that connects to jobs here at home. And we saw quite a bit of that at the presidential debate, you know, when there was discussing China or Mitt Romney talking about the opportunities in Latin America. Foreign policy as a mechanism of job creation is certainly a smart pivot for candidates to play. And I think voters are receptive to that.
You know, it's interesting what you said, Wayne, and you come from a military family yourself. How do military families perhaps hear these messages a little bit differently than non-military families?
Well, obviously the strains of deployment, the difficulties of loved ones being sent, you know, into harm's way, weighs heavily on those families. And so that's obviously a consideration. We want to know that when troops are sent abroad, that it's for a good reason, that they're going to be well-trained, well-cared for, and that families back home will have support systems. And they also want to hear their candidates talk about ways in which, you know, the lives of military family members are going to be improved. I mean, we've done shows, Laura, before about how tough it has been for the VA system to handle all the incoming needs of veterans coming home. But also on defense spending. I mean, this issue of sequestration keeps coming up. And what are the impacts going to be for military families or folks who work for defense-related industries? And one of the things that I think is a big deal that we've already seen commercials about is the horses and bayonets comment from the presidential election and how that might impact Navy families down in places like Virginia and Florida.
Yeah, what do you think, Chris? Let's get your thoughts, too, just broadly on how you hear both the presidential candidates this year and our candidates for Congress framing these big issues of foreign policy.
Well, I think if you look at the debate on Monday night, what you saw was, again and again, the president came back to what you could call the commander-in-chief card. He kept going back to the fact that he's been president for 4 years. These aren't abstract issues for him. They're real issues that he's dealt with and made decisions about. And I think he was, in doing that, he was trying to draw a contrast with Governor Romney, who just simply hasn't had hands-on foreign policy experience. And I think that reflected it in the candidate's demeanors.
The same position Barack Obama was in 4 years ago.
Yes. Although even then, Senator Obama had been on the Foreign Relations Committee. And so as a senator, he had a little bit more firsthand experience. But again, not a lot of it. But, you know, Governor Romney throughout the debate Monday night just seemed really sort of, I don't want to say uncomfortable, but, you know, less than fully engaged and seemed not interested in making contrasts with the president the way he had in the previous debates, but in emphasizing areas of agreement, but then suggesting, well, we do something similar, but I'd do it better, or I'd be a better manager, or we'd have a better outcome.
Our phone number for you to join us on this subject is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we continue our Issue of the Week series. This is where we pick one major issue in this year's campaigns and focus on it for the hour. This hour, it's where the candidates stand on foreign policy. Let's get your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. As a voter, how important is this to you when you go into the voting booth to make your decision? And what aspects of this broad area of foreign policy do you want to hear more from the candidates, especially our congressional candidates here in New Hampshire? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. And Katie's calling from Jaffrey. Hi, Katie. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I wanted to say that members of the Romney family avoid military service, yet Mr. Romney wants us to vote for him to be president and commander-in-chief. No one in Mitt Romney's family has served in the military, not his grandfather, not his father, nor any of his siblings have joined the military, and none of his sons have joined. Yet, while Mitt Romney was a student at Stanford, he supported the Vietnam War, but instead of joining the military, he went to France for 3 years and served as a draft-exempt missionary.
Now, Katie, there are other candidates who don't, in the past, have military experience or come from a military family, Bill Clinton, for example. So, you know, why is that so important to you?
He wants to be commander-in-chief, and his family, through the years, can you name someone who's joined the military? President Obama's grandfather was an American soldier during World War II, Vice President Joe Biden's son is a captain in the National Guard and served in Iraq. So Obama, Biden have people in their family who have served in the military.
Katie, thanks a lot for the call. And, you know, I'm glad she called, Wayne, because this is something that our congressional candidates have talked a lot about. If you've got a military person in your family, even several generations back, boy, you talk about it, don't you?
Sure. And, I mean, it adds, you know, I guess, some credibility to conversations about sending young men and women into harm's way. But as you pointed out, we've had, you know, multiple presidents who did not serve, who chose not to serve. President Obama did not serve, and neither is Mitt Romney. This is something that's been coming up quite a bit more recently from the left to sort of whack Mitt Romney, who's been talking about a more muscular military and making sure that we have a strong level of defense spending and all of that, as a way of sort of criticizing him and saying, gee, you know, when your opportunity to serve came, you chose not to do it. I also wonder sometimes if it's not a veiled way of bringing up the Mormonism and the, you know, the missionary work that he did in France instead of going into the service at that particular phase in his life. But, you know, I don't know.
Chris, I want to hear from you, too, on this. I was going over yesterday the positions of our congressional candidates here in New Hampshire, and everyone talks about some sort of a military background, mm-hmm. and everyone is very quick to say that, and this is Republican, Democrat, far right, far left, everyone says, if elected, I will, you know, do my best to support veterans and their families. It's kind of mom and apple pie, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's because, you know, veterans, everybody loves veterans. You know, when you're talking, if you're a Democrat who wants to talk about the role government can play in people's lives, then you talk about veterans because there's no perception that veterans are, you know, undeserving of public largesse or undeserving of health care in the way that, you know, other social welfare spending it might be looked at. If you are a Republican, talking about veterans shows that, you know, not only do you care about the military, but then you care about the military when they come home. So I think wherever you sit, whichever party you're in, it's a win-win for you.
All right. Well, and thanks for that call, Katie. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And when we come back, more on where this year's candidates stand on foreign policy.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Thanks to everyone who contributed to NHPR's fall member drive. We fell a little short of our goal, so if you didn't get around to making your gift, you can still do so online at nhpr.org or with a phone call to 1-888-805-6477. And thanks. New Hampshire weather today becoming partly sunny with a high of 60 to 65 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling. For any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem, offering annual tune-ups and efficient heating systems, online at justcallheritage.com. From Vineyard Brands, importers of Mann wines from the coastal vineyards of South Africa, Mann Vintners proudly supports the Susan B. Komen Race for the Cure. mannvintners.co.za. And the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank, trust in wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs. TheMerrimack.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we continue our Issue of the Week series with where this year's contenders stand on foreign policy. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. How much does foreign policy factor into your voting decisions? What issues in this area do you think the candidates need to talk about more, especially among our congressional candidates here in New Hampshire? One more time, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our callers and welcome Bob from Hollis on the air. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hello, Laura. Yeah, just coincidentally, I arrived home late last night from after having spent the last week in Beijing, China.
Wow.
So your show is very timely for me.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to make one comment that my colleagues and I over there had more than a number of laughs in regards to what the governor had mentioned in terms of what he would do the first day in office with regards to currency manipulation. But anyway, my comment is that foreign policy to me as still an undecided voter in New Hampshire is quite important because the difficulty I have is I can't disassociate some of the foreign policy decisions that have occurred in the last 8 years with the economic impact that they bring to the United States. And I'm thinking most in terms of what happened in the Middle East and how we committed troops there and just the billions and trillions of dollars of debt that we've run up as a result of that.
You know, I'm interested, though, Bob, you say you've got business in China. Are you in manufacturing or...?
I actually work in the energy sector.
Okay.
I work for a multinational firm, and I'm a business development manager, so I spend a lot of time actually in the Asia-Pacific region.
So you must be interested in what these candidates have to say about trade, right? And
very definitely.
Yeah.
Very definitely. You know, and what I find very frustrating is the simplicity of the things that they're talking about, especially in regards to China and some of the other countries that I know I do a lot of business with, like Russia, to simplistically state that Russia is a geopolitical threat. And I forget exactly what Romney had mentioned specifically, but it's clearly not to the broad brush electorate that he's trying to appeal, I think, with these chest-thumping sort of statements.
All right. Well, Bob, this is an important call because I'm glad you called, Bob, because Kirk Dorsey, this is another area where the seemingly far offshores issue of foreign policy really touches our daily lives, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I think the governor is trying to make a case, to come back to Wayne's earlier point about tying foreign policy to jobs, that the United States will be able to have more manufacturing jobs if we can only get China under control. And I think he's in a little bit of a bind because he wants to push this notion that he'll be tougher on China, but it's hard to say what you could do in a very complex relationship in a short soundbite. And frankly, he probably doesn't have a very clear sense of what he can do until he gets into the White House and sees, if he gets into the White House, and sees the options ahead of him. I think that's a fairly common thing in these campaigns is the challenger in particular has the opportunity to speak in broad, almost platitudes because the challenger hasn't had to make policy, and then can get into the White House and actually have to make decisions. And I think it's fairly common the president makes decisions that are different from the broad outlines that are laid out. So I think the China policy is, it seems to me that that's part of the general, this is an election about jobs theme. And the Russia comment about Russia being the geopolitical threat seems to me to be talking to a particular piece of his base that he wants to reassure that he will be a tough leader. Because you compare that with his language about, you can't kill your way out of these problems, and I want a foreign policy of peace. It seems like the rhetoric is sort of working across purposes there. And I think he's trying to placate different parts of the constituency and speak to the undecided voters that he's not an echo of the George W. Bush administration's, that he's got a more subtle foreign policy.
Given our caller's concern about
yes.
the wars and the impact on our economy. You know, it's interesting, just picking up on what you said, Kirk, and Chris, I'll throw this to you. I was interested watching the debate on Monday night. You know, both candidates said, you know, I'll be tougher on this, I'll encourage this. But, you know, these countries and the people that lead them have their own minds and their own policies. So you can sit up there and say, I'll do this, I'll do that. But, you know, China or Russia or Libya, to some extent, they're going to do what they want.
Yeah, that's right. And these are countries that have their own leaderships. They have, and their leaders have their own political concerns. They're worried about getting reelected or maintaining their term in office if they're not a democratic nation. And so, you know, what a president can do on foreign policy is really in a very large extent hemmed in by what other people are willing to do. And so, you know, presidents have more freedom in foreign policy than they do in domestic policy, but that freedom is still limited by how people react to you. And so it's not just, you know, sitting in the White House and issuing orders and all of a sudden China stops manipulating currency and Japan drops all of its trade barriers. It's really, you know, it's a lot of nudging and back and forth and compromise, and that's not the kind of thing you necessarily can pitch to voters very easily.
Well, and another question on Bob's trade-related concern, and again, it's real interesting to hear from him because he just got back. He's got business in China all the time. Wayne L'Esperance, New Hampshire companies, as you know, have proven themselves in the export market. What do you hear our congressional candidates saying about this constellation of trade issues and business issues that they're concerned about, like our caller Bob?
Well, no, that's a great point. I mean, this has come up in a number of the debates and the forums that the candidates have participated in. And it's fairly similar, frankly, the idea of creating a more job-friendly state or marketplace in New Hampshire to bring businesses in and then to encourage those businesses, particularly as they work abroad, is something that the candidates have talked about quite a bit. I think it's interesting to listen to them talk about China because they on the one hand do want to follow the top of the tickets in terms of how we interact with China, but even the Republican candidates will say to you that, you know, we want to make sure we have opportunities for more business, greater volume of trade with China because and other countries because that's good for New Hampshire. So there may be a little bit of daylight between the rhetoric from the top of the ticket on the Republican side and what the congressional candidates are saying here on the ground. By the way, one other quick point on the bigger picture, the kind of tough talk on China that Romney was offering plays very well in states like Ohio, right? And that's a really key state in this election. So I think that's part of helps explain part of why we hear this sort of more muscular language from the challenger than the president.
Well, and we do hear this muscular language on China from our congressional candidates as well. And Kirk, to you, what do you think about the idea that China's kind of become a convenient punching bag in this election for Democratic and Republican candidates? What do you think, Kirk?
Well, I think it makes perfect sense because China is a country that is getting more assertive in its foreign policy. It now has an aircraft carrier. It's not much of an aircraft carrier, but it has an aircraft carrier. And, you know, the only other we have 12 of them, or maybe we're down to 11 now. And what's interesting is one of the things the United States did when China got an aircraft carrier is ask, why does China need an aircraft carrier, which I thought was a very interesting question from a country with 11 or 12 aircraft carriers. But it was still an interesting assertion that China is a country in its foreign policy that the rest of the Asian nations are suspicious of. And so what are its intentions as it's going to be a more of a naval power? So there is a geopolitical struggle going on between the United States and China for influence throughout East Asia. The Obama administration has been very public about pivoting its foreign policy towards Asia, and clearly the idea is to reassure allies that the United States will be there in case China does embark on a more assertive foreign policy, which is not unimaginable. China's got these struggles going on right now with countries throughout Asia, the Philippines, Vietnam, China, South Korea, over these small islands that ownership of them may lead to access to energy resources. And China's being pretty assertive, and the other countries in the area are very worried about it. And you combine that with the huge trade imbalance between the United States and China. And as Wayne said, particularly in my home state of Ohio, where the Rust Belt has been rusting away, and it's easy to blame the Chinese for the lack of industrial jobs. It's just so easy to take what China is actually doing, plus the perception of the loss of American jobs to China. And make that an easy scapegoat.
Yeah, it's nice to have somebody to blame, isn't it?
It is nice to have somebody to blame, yeah.
What do you think, Chris?
I agree. And I think when you're dealing with these Rust Belt states, when you're dealing with places that have had declining manufacturing bases, it's a great thing for a candidate to be able to say the fault is elsewhere and the fault is with some outside actor. And if you elect me, I will be tough with them and, you know, somehow that will improve the state of the economy in Michigan or Ohio or Pennsylvania.
So there's these code words here that are embedded within this broader foreign policy discussion, which resonate with certain groups of voters.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, it's our Issue of the Week series. And this hour, we're looking at what this year's contenders have been saying about foreign policies. We're looking at that, especially topics that touch us here at home, including troop deployments, veterans issues, trade issues. Later on, we'll talk about immigration. The number for you to join us again is 1-800-892-6477. Even though we're told foreign policy isn't that important to most voters this time around, how important is it for you when you go into the voting booth? And specifically, what issues in this broad area of foreign policy do you think the candidates should be talking about more, especially here in the Granite State? One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. Gentlemen, one more sort of economic/foreign policy question, because this did come up a lot this week, and it has come up a lot, both in our congressional discussions here in New Hampshire. And Kirk Dorsey, this is for you. One omission that I have heard from all our foreign policy discussions is the uncertainty around the European economy in general and the euro specifically. How much do you hear candidates, Kirk, this year talking about instability in the European economy?
I haven't heard it at all. And at a certain level, I can understand that because Europe can't even handle Europe's problems. So there's not much we can do about Europe's problems. But it would be nice to know that that one president, or one candidate or the other, has a plan for what to do. You know, if Spain has an economic meltdown and that causes problems throughout Europe, it will certainly resonate into the United States in terms of the possibility of a double-dip recession. And if you pile that on to all the domestic economic problems we already have and the fiscal cliff and all those things coming, this is a real crisis as we're likely to face, given that Europe can't get itself out of this hole. But it doesn't seem to be a source of discussion. Actually, I'm kind of surprised because I would think that Romney, as a businessman, could be making the argument that this actually is one area where he would have some sort of expertise that might be able to help the United States weather a storm and understand international trade issues better. But he doesn't seem to want to go there. And I'm not sure if that's just because that's just not resonating with voters at all, or if the complexities of it are such that that there's no easy answer to offer at this point.
Chris, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we're not hearing Romney talking about it so much is because a lot of the countries that are having economic problems in Europe are the same ones that have imposed austerity measures. And those measures have not had the economic effect that the people who implemented them intended. And I don't know that there's a lot of difference between austerity plans that are being put into place in Europe and a lot of the discussion from Governor Romney and from other Republicans about cutting domestic spending in the United States. And so if you have an object lesson that suggests maybe what you're planning wouldn't work that well, I think that's a really strong incentive to not talk about that very much.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And as we talk, gentlemen, about the intersection of businesses here in New Hampshire, international affairs, especially trade, here's an email from Kevin who says, "It seems to me you are all dancing around the points. Please ask the listener, does he feel Mitt Romney is wrong about China does manipulate the currency? It is not so much he said it, do you agree or disagree with it? The Chinese government supports their industrial base so they can grow. Solar is a great example. Kevin says China owns the USA because of the debt we owe them. Now they will start becoming a stronger military power." Kevin, thanks a lot for the point. I guess I'll throw this to you, Wayne. What do you think about the points that Kevin's raising? Specifically, it is true that China manipulates its currency, is it not, Wayne?
I would say it is. I would say it's true that they violate patents, that there's all kinds of activities that the Chinese government engages in that, you know, are problematic or are just flat out wrong. The issue isn't so much diagnosing the problem. I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of disagreement between the president and Mitt Romney on what the problems are with China. The issue is how do you, you know, what's the policy solution? What do you do to address those challenges? And that's where they clearly have some difference. So, you know, I don't know that we're dancing around it. I think we probably largely agree that there are these issues out there. I think the question becomes, what do we do about it?
You know, one of you mentioned earlier a military policy pivoting more toward Asia. That's what the Obama administration has been doing. Kirk Dorsey, I think that was you. And that has come up again as we look at international affairs touching us here in New Hampshire. Kirk, that's come up because there are concerns that the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard might be threatened by this pivot towards Asia. The folks who work there say, no, that's not happening, and they're booked for years and years and years in terms of work. But how are the candidates talking about, you know, where we should put our military might and how that might affect us here at home, Kirk?
Well, I think the specifics on where to put military might are not being addressed quite so much, other than that great bayonets and horses line. So maybe that's the line that will be remembered from this debate cycle and this election cycle. You know, I think they both are saying that the United States is going to have to be a more technologically powerful military. And it's interesting that there's an agreement, really, like there's an agreement that China presents certain kinds of problems, but the disagreement is how to solve those problems. There's an agreement that the U.S. military has to be by far the largest military in the world and has to have the technological capabilities better than anybody else in the world, and therefore have more aircraft carrier battle groups and more high-powered airplanes than anyone in the world, and that's part of the American mission. And what's striking to me is that they're not really, two of them are not really debating that, and there's nobody really challenging them on that assertion. It's interesting that there's not been much of a tie between the budget deficit problem and military spending. I can understand why they don't want to suggest that budgets have to be balanced on the backs of veterans. That's just really good politics and probably a moral policy as well. But it is striking that neither candidate's willing to say we have to have serious defense cuts to make this work, to try to balance the budget in the long run, other than we're going to save money from not fighting in Afghanistan any further. So it seems to me there's in many ways a basic agreement about the force deployment that both candidates, and I think what happens usually when presidents get into office is they basically end up listening to their military advisors. Unless you're General Eisenhower and you have 5 stars on your shoulder, you usually respect those guys who have 4 stars on their shoulders.
All right, let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Barbara in Manchester. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura and guests. This has been fantastic. You have been addressing so many of my questions. You leave me only one. By the way, I'm glad that Bob brought up the effect on our budget deficits, and we're, you know, only speaking to one side of the system. However, my question that really gets to me is there the threat of cyber attacks on this country. Nobody brings that up and how to protect against it. Oh, and secondly, very quickly, going back to the cost of these wars, I remember when they had it down to the average per day for Iraq. Do any of you remember Iraq, and what is it for Afghanistan? That's my second question. Thank you very much.
Well, Barbara, yeah, thanks for the call. And how about that first point then, Chris Galdieri? Are you hearing anybody talk about cyber attacks? I think there was a big news item on this earlier this week.
I have not heard much of it in the campaigns at all. Certainly didn't hear it in the debate. But I think, yeah, that is a real concern and something that people are worried about. And it's also something that we've used ourselves. We now know that early in the Obama administration, the government was essentially hacking Iran's nuclear program and just, you know, throwing some spanners into the works here and there in a very subtle way to just keep things off kilter. And if we can do it to someone else, it's entirely possible that someone will try to do it to us.
Yeah, getting to that issue that was talked a lot about in several of these debates, whether Iran is closer to building a nuclear weapon and so forth. Well, and you touched also on homeland security with the thoughts on cyber attacks, Chris. Yet another way that these foreign policy issues are felt in our local campaigns as well. So we'll talk more about that after a short break. You can call us too at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Curia Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting Printmaking in the Age of Rembrandt, featuring prints by Rembrandt and his contemporaries from the Dutch Golden Age, courier.org. And from Goodwill Industries of Northern New England, reminding you that donations make a difference in people's lives. Details about the donate movement at goodwillnne.org/donate. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
On the next Fresh Air, some of the latest developments at Gitmo, a subject that was barely mentioned in the presidential debates. Award-winning Canadian journalist Michelle Shepard has been to Gitmo over 24 times. She even got enough stamps on her Gitmo Starbucks card for a free latte. She's the national security correspondent for the Toronto Star. Join us. Fresh Air, today at 3 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, hopeful signs in the housing market, both nationally and here in New Hampshire. Email us your thoughts at exchange@nhpr.org before the program, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, where the candidates stand on foreign policy. Call us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on The Exchange page at nhpr.org. Our guests are Chris Galdieri, Assistant Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College, Kirk Dorsey, Professor of History at UNH with an expertise in U.S. foreign policy, and Wayne Lesperance, Professor of Political Science at New England College. One more time, that exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, before we go back to the phones, I did want to touch on something that just came up a couple minutes ago. And Kirk Dorsey, that's the idea of homeland security. Again, another area where foreign policy touches us directly. You don't hear that much about it this year, Kirk, do you?
Yeah, it's surprising that, you know, with the 10th anniversary of 9/11 just passing, that we have not heard more direct discussion about this. And I wonder if the Obama administration might have tried to make it more of an issue before the attack in Libya on the embassy, then the whole question of where Al-Qaeda was, that they might have felt that they couldn't really push that card too hard. Because it seems like that's one of the things that the Obama administration, they certainly pushed the idea that we got Osama bin Laden, but it's interesting they didn't seem to then swing that back. And I don't know whether it's just a concern that you're just asking for trouble if you start saying we've secured the homeland in our 4 years, or if they have some other reason for thinking that it's a card that won't resonate. But it seems to me that's one that they could play more vigorously than they have and make some more points. And again, they could come back to Governor Romney and say, you have no experience doing this, so you can talk all you want, but we've actually done it.
Well, and the one thing that I've heard our congressional candidates here in New Hampshire, Wayne, talk about is the fiscal cliff, which one of you raised before. Our candidates have said that they're concerned if automatic spending cuts do indeed go into effect, the defense budget will be cut too deeply, they say, putting our national security at risk. New Hampshire Senators Ayotte and Representatives Ginta and Bass have even written a letter to congressional leaders urging them to rethink this. What do you think, Wayne, about this connection between, boy, it's all connected, isn't it? The deficit, the debt, the possibility of the fiscal cliff, and jobs and homeland security here in New Hampshire.
Okay, so we have a whole other hour for this, right?
I know, exactly.
You know where there is broad bipartisan support is on this issue of sequestration. Nobody wants to see those Defense Department cuts put into effect. At a recent debate out on the Seacoast, to listen to Carol Shea Porter talk about the importance of the Department of Defense, the importance of that Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, you would have to wonder what party she was from. It was a very strong and full-throated support for both, because she recognizes that those cuts could have a direct impact in our own backyard. And this is a national narrative, so there's quite a bit of bipartisan support to try to make sure that those DOD cuts don't actually take place. The president, you'll recall, said that it's not going to happen. He just flat out said it won't happen at the debate on Monday night. You know, one thing that you didn't mention, Laura, is immigration, which can be tied into this foreign policy conversation. It is something that relates to homeland security, but it too is something that hasn't gotten a whole lot of focus in this election. And I think I want to guess that last election, there was quite a bit more discussion of immigration issues. And even at the congressional level here in New Hampshire, we hear them talking a little bit about it, but not a whole lot. So another one of those issues from last cycle that doesn't seem to have percolated up this time.
Well, there has been some discussion. You're right, Wayne, not a whole lot. Looking at the candidates' websites, they all seem to say, I support legal immigration, not illegal immigration. Okay, that's kind of a no-brainer there. There is some daylight, though, Wayne, between them. Republicans tend to say, I do not think illegal immigrants deserve amnesty. I think local law enforcement should be encouraged to report illegal immigrants. That's from Frank Ginta's website, right, for example. That's an issue that's come up with that Arizona law, right, Wayne, where,
right,
do local police play a role in enforcing national immigration laws? That's daylight between Republicans and Democrats, right, Wayne?
Right, right. And Frank Ginta has said that states who do not follow the federal immigration laws need to be punished in some form. So there's a more law enforcement, more forceful, I think, approach from Ginta and Bass on this issue. You know, Annie Custer has said that, you know, there ought not to have to be a touchback. You shouldn't have to go back to come back in. There ought to be a path to citizenship for illegals. And then I think all of them are saying, you know, expanding the visas that we do have, that we do offer, so that we can attract more of the best and the brightest in the world here to the United States. And I think we've also heard about this idea that folks who come here from abroad for advanced degrees, I forget who said it, but someone said we ought to staple a green card to their PhD or their doctorate, and so they can actually come and work here in the United States and bring those talents here. So,
yeah, that's controversial, though, Wayne, isn't it? Because some people say on the other side, hey, how about beefing up our community colleges and, you know, having our own folks take those jobs?
Absolutely. And if we talk to folks in the service industry, the tourism industry, they are crying every summer for more visas to allow more workers to come in to help run their facilities during high tourism season. So absolutely. Again, it's where we haven't had quite kind of that real substantive conversation on this issue like so many others, that would help us to see really where the candidates are beyond the sort of law and order and illegals, sure, but not illegals kind of conversation.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Jack in Vermont. Hi, Jack. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Ms. Canoy. I would like to remind all the veterans' families in New England that I go to the White River Junction facility, and we've been talking about this all summer long, that Mr. Ryan in his budget had a 20% cut for the VA. Of course, people don't realize, but the VA is the third largest item in the budget. So for two people who never served a day in their life in the military, I had to chuckle. I said, they want to cut 20% out of this was Ryan's budget. This is out in the open here. And I haven't heard any talk about, they say, oh, we all support veterans. But both parties have done it, whether it's Democrat or Republican. When the war ends and the bugles end and whatever, they look for ways to cut the budget.
Jack, thanks a lot for calling in. Kirk, you want to chime in on that one?
Well, I think that to some extent that's true, but it does strike me that this cycle seems different to me than, say, Vietnam or Korea. Maybe not World War II, but you know, World War II, there is the booming home front economy. In terms of the way veterans are treated, I mean, it's really striking if you compare it just to Vietnam, where you know there's so much angst about the war and the role that our soldiers play in the war. But there's been almost none of that questioning of the veterans out of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. There's just been a sort of unquestioning acceptance of what they've done, which I think is really striking. I think it's a response to perhaps too many questions being asked of the veterans and not enough of the leaders about the Vietnam War itself. So I think he's right that Paul Ryan, you know, his budget includes a lot of these drastic cuts as a way, if they're not going to raise taxes, as a way to get back to a balanced budget. But they certainly haven't been pushing that on the campaign trail, because I think if you were to ask Governor Romney directly, so do you support the 20% cut in the VA or whatever the cut is, he would of course say, well, no, that's one detail that you know Congressman Ryan and I disagree on, and we'll work around that. It does seem to me that there's a very real chance that there will have to be cuts if we're ever going to get to a balanced budget, though. That's one thing. And it seems to me, if I'm not mistaken, sequestration does not actually include cuts for veterans' benefits. That's one of the things I believe that was protected. I may be wrong about that.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call. And our number for you to join us on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477, as we talk about some of the foreign policy issues that are being discussed in this presidential election year, and how some of these issues really do touch us directly here in New Hampshire. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I want to raise one more foreign policy issue, at least with you, and that's Afghanistan. And boy, sure, it's been discussed a little bit. It was discussed in the vice presidential debate. It was discussed in the presidential debate, Chris Caldieri, on Monday night. But not as much as you would think, given that this has been going on for so long, given that so many American lives have been lost there.
No, I agree. I think the fact that there is now a date for withdrawal set in 2014, and that by and large, everyone seems to agree on that. You know, you've seen, Governor Romney sort of said, well, I don't like the idea of a deadline, but if you elect me, we'll be out in 2014, but it won't be the same deadline. Or, people say, well, we shouldn't be there anymore, but we shouldn't have a firm deadline. But I think it just comes down to the country being tired of it. And it's been a long time in Afghanistan. It's really unclear to a lot of voters what the purpose of our continuing to be there is. And I think finding and killing Osama bin Laden put a button on that for a lot of Americans. And I think the fact that he wasn't in Afghanistan, that he was in Pakistan, and the fact that, well, if he was the one who attacked us and we got him, I think that really sort of settled it for a lot of people.
You know, and it's interesting, Chris, and we hear candidates, again, not just for president, but our congressional candidates as well, talk about a continuing presence where, and here's the rhetoric usually here, let the Afghans take charge of their own future. And everyone hears that and says, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. But as you well know, boy, we've had a lot of these green on blue attacks where, you know, the Afghan trainees have turned on their NATO and American commanders. And you think, wow, can we even do that?
Yeah, and I also think that doesn't make anyone want us to be there any longer. And I think that sort of thing, especially at this point, just increases everyone's just frustration and desire to just be done with it and be back home.
Well, and here's some of the language that we've heard from our local candidates, Wayne. Carol Shea Porter, for example, has said she supports a, quote, light footprint in Afghanistan. Charlie Bass has said he, quote, supports redefining our mission in Afghanistan. What are you hearing our congressional candidates say about this, Wayne? And if you could add in there, please, how much does any one member of Congress really influence policy in Afghanistan anyway?
Well, let's try the second one first. Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot at all, really. And, in fact, their positions aren't all that different, really. I think the one that's probably the most, troop-heavy is Frank Ginta, who has said that there are going to be troops in Afghanistan beyond 2014, that we have to have them there, and that really the key is in defining what that's going to look like. But all are supportive of the drawdown and bringing troops out. Carol Shea Porter historically has been more aggressive about this. She did not support, for example, the buildup, the troop buildup that the president supported with the 30,000 additional troops in the surge. So, you know, for the most part, there's not a whole lot of daylight between them. There's a little bit in terms of Frank Ginta's position. But at the end of the day, a single member of Congress from New Hampshire's 1st and 2nd congressional district aren't going to make a whole lot of difference. Except that they're echoing what they're hearing nationally, and that is exactly what we've been saying, and that is people are tired of this war. We're not sure what the point is anymore, and really every time another soldier is killed or we're spending another $2 billion a week, what's the point? And I think that's the dominant narrative now.
And that's where Congress does come in, right, Wayne, where, you know, they do have the power of the purse. So if a president said, I want to spend X bazillion more, you know, a member of Congress could vote for or against that. That's where they
But that's mostly a, you know, symbolic in a sense, because at the end of the day, if the president, you know, orders troops into a place, it's difficult for Congress to say, well, we're not going to write the check to support that deployment, because then they're accused of not supporting our troops who are in harm's way. So it's tough to actually exercise the power of the purse in this particular case.
Well, Kirk, one last question for you. Is there one particular foreign policy issue that you think is super important that we've heard nothing at all about?
Well, I think the two that we haven't heard anything about, if I may double down, one is that we didn't hear anything about global warming and international efforts to regulate that.
Talking about that on the radio earlier this week. Nothing about climate change. Instead, a discussion about who loves coal more.
Right, which is remarkable. I mean, in many ways, what I think is really fascinating is I really want to read Barack Obama's third memoir, where he writes about what he really believes in foreign policy, because the one who campaigned in 2008 doesn't sound like the one who campaigns in 2012 at all. There's, you know, the hopes and aspirations and the reason that people around the world were looking to him for a new direction from the United States. And as the New York Times said the other day, around the world, it looks like most people are looking at Barack Obama, and I think they quoted a German who said, well, he's a mean politician like everybody else, that there seems to be this really major shift in his language. You know, I was even thinking that if you watch enough football, you see these ads for the U.S. Marine Corps, and there's one where they always, it's like a video game. They're running, and they're tanks and planes, all this stuff. And it ends with this tag, United States Marine Corps, a global force for good. And I'm thinking, boy, I wonder when Barack Obama is commander-in-chief, you know, really got the idea that the Marine Corps is a global force for good, rather than a much more nuanced view of American foreign policy and the way force has been used and these sorts of things. And so I think it's really fascinating how I can't tell whether it's one of those situations where he got in the White House and he saw the world differently from sitting in the Oval Office, or if he's been thinking, well, I need to get reelected and these are political realities of the day.
Well, and Kirk, on the climate change point, I remember from 2008, a planet in peril was
right.
One of the first things, you know, he would say, we have two wars, an economy in shambles, a planet in peril. Those were his three talking points, and now we don't hear about that anymore.
I think he even said something, we'll remember this day as the day the planet stopped warming or something like that, you know, that basically this is grand promise. It makes sense. Again, this comes back to many of us have been saying about this, that this is an election about jobs. And for whatever reason, you know, the deep history of the United States dealing with the environment, the idea of environmental protection is usually paired as anti-jobs. Whether that's accurate or not is subject for another show, perhaps. But so if he comes off strong and saying, you know, we're gonna combat global warming, it's going to be so easy to rip that apart as saying, well, look at all the jobs you'll be costing. And so I think he sort of assumes that his supporters are on board with that. And so He's not going to make a big issue of it, but he presumes his supporters know that he will be more friendly to environmentalists than the Romney administration.
Interesting. Well, and one last question. I'll throw it to you, I think, Chris. This is kind of a speculation game, but here goes.
Okay.
No matter who's elected, Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, will have a new Secretary of State. Is that correct?
That's right. Hillary Clinton has been pretty clear that she is in this for one term and one term only.
And so someone else will step in. A lot of people are looking at Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair John Kerry.
Yes.
Barack Obama.
Yeah. Senator Kerry seems to be sending a lot of signals that he'd like to be Secretary of State. It'd be a nice cap to his political career. What would be really, I hesitate to use the word exciting about that, but exciting about that is that would be, mean another Senate election in Massachusetts early next year.
Oh, give us more to talk about.
Yes,
are you sick
yes.
of elections
so,
yet, Chris?
Yeah, so, Scott Brown or Elizabeth Warren, whoever doesn't come out on top, could make another run at it next year.
Well, and for Mr. Romney, one person he cannot choose, gentlemen, would be Colin Powell. Colin Powell has endorsed Barack Obama for president, did it this morning on CBS This Morning Thursday. Wayne Lesperance, who might Mitt Romney go for if he's elected president?
Oh, boy, there's a very long and distinguished cast of characters that could certainly play that role. But my vote, and this is never going to happen, will be John McCain.
For Secretary of State for Mitt
sure.
Romney. Wow.
Sure.
Okay, well, we've got you on record, Wayne.
Right, and I don't believe it's going to happen, but good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot, Wayne, for joining us. We sure appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Wayne Lesperance, Professor of Political Science at New England College, Director of the Center for Civic Engagement there. Kirk Dorsey, thank you for taking the time out for us this morning.
Thank you, Laura. My pleasure.
Kirk Dorsey, Professor of History at UNH. His areas of expertise include U.S. foreign policy. And Chris Galdieri, thank you for coming in. It was good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Chris Galdieri, Assistant Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College, who specializes in presidential politics. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.